Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My guest on Podcasting Them Softly. Very, very excited to have him on. He is a visual effects and makeup effects legend, Jeff Farley. Since 1977, when he got his start on a little film that you may or may not have seen, I certainly have, is Kingdom of Spiders. He has gone on to work on multiples of films, television, in those different capacities in visual effects and makeup effects. And we're also going to be talking about a film that is currently in circulation right now to go along with Steve Latcher interview, Return of the Killer Shrews. But Jeff, it is wonderful to have you on Podcasting Softly.
Oh, thank you so much, Kent. It's a pleasure to speak to you. And hello to everyone in Australia.
That's fantastic. So, Jeff, for the uninitiated who listen to us, who may or may not be aware of you and your work, even though they probably have seen it, if they listen to this podcast, they obviously love films. So they probably have seen your work but don't know about yourself. Could you give us a little bit of history about yourself prior to your break with Kingdom of Spiders?
Well, I was born in the Los Angeles suburb of Glendale, and without knowing it, I mean, as I was growing up, I had no idea that I was sort of in the middle of the hub of where, a lot of the film industry was going on. Of course, I was fascinated with film because of maybe around age five at my grandmother's house, I caught King Kong when it was on television one day, and it had already been on for a while, but I had no idea what it was, and I caught a scene from it, and I was hooked. I was just fascinated, and like anybody else at that age, you have no idea how it's done. All you know is that what you're seeing in front of you has to be done somehow. Right. So I instantly became, into monsters. My brother had an Aurora Frankenstein kit, and that too sort of piqued my interest. And then I started collecting that stuff, and eventually I started reading the pages of the Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. And then I was, in my teens, I was introduced to the editor of Famous Monsters, Forrest J. Ackerman, who, it turns out, my stepmother had dated one of the guys working at his place. Yeah. And so it was just by happenstance we stopped by, and he wasn't in town, Forrest wasn't in town, but we were invited in, and the first person we ran into was this ex-boyfriend of my stepmother's. And so 2 weeks later, Forrest was back in town and said he had heard my birthday was coming up and invited me over, and a couple of my friends went over with me, and John Landis shows up out of the blue. So, little by little, I started, thanks to Forrest and him introducing me to people like Jim Danforth. And then through there, I was able to meet David Allen and Dennis Muren. And it turns out they're all in the phone book. I could just call these people up, just find their home numbers and bug them. That was a lot of my childhood. I made a pest of myself, and somehow I think at least was endearing enough and earnest enough for people to give me some time.
Yeah.
Which is something that, I was trying to pass on to others who are interested equally.
I know the feeling, Jeff. That's kind of what I'm still doing. Except instead of the phone book, it's Facebook.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I've been a serial pest, but not to bother these professionals such as yourself, simply because I have such a passion for cinema and a great admiration for what you all do. Very similar, I guess, to the way you did it back then, and just wanted to talk shop. and that sort of thing. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, a lot of the joy of working in the industry is working with people that I grew up seeing getting to know them. And that's a lot of the fun. But beyond that, actually, at 4E, invited me over to meet Ray Harryhausen.
Oh, wow.
And I met a guy who was, had been working in the industry over at at Berman Studios and on films like Empire of the Ants and stuff like that. And then he was working for Steve Neal on Kingdom of the Spiders, and Steve had farmed out a bunch of, the manufacturer of about 300 of these background spiders, which I was told may not even be in the film. So, what a great disappointment. My friends and I spent a couple of weeks in this apartment, cramped apartment in Glendale, helping make these spiders and Dremel down all the seams off of them and stuff. And we never got the masks we were promised, so it was sort of like that was the initiation into the industry. But it still was fascinating, and everyone was really cool, and it seemed like a much better prospect than taking over my dad's sheet metal business. sometimes I regret the decision.
Well,
I made money for taking over a business.
This business, the film industry, is definitely a business of feast and famine. Wouldn't you agree? You have sort of great.
Absolutely.
You have great runs.
For sure, definitely, absolutely. It seems like nobody has money in the industry. Anyway, everybody has deep pockets, so they don't have any money at all.
Yeah.
They're always waiting for it to show up. it's a bit maddening, but it's the way it's always been. Beyond that, I got really lucky. One of the editors of Star Wars, a guy named Richard Chu, lived three houses down from me.
Right.
This is after Star Wars had been released, and we found out that, this person, this family moving down the street, the husband had worked on Star Wars, and I was at his place all the time. I was holding his, going in and holding his Oscar and babysitting his kids when his wife went out. So it was really an interesting neighborhood I grew up in. It was kind of affluent, yet there were a lot of industry people that lived around me.
That's incredible. So Steve, Jeff. I'm in Steve mode this morning. Jeff,
I like that name,
because I'm thinking about Killer Shrews, because I've got Steve on the brain. Mm-hmm. But Jeff, you've done so many movies, and we can't possibly cover all of them, but I've sort of handpicked a few of my favorites among the ones that you've worked on, both credited and unaccredited. And I wondered if you could maybe sort of give us any little stories or things you might remember. I've always been a big fan of the Empire catalog of movies. From the days of a couple in particular, Arena and Robot Jocks. I know that you didn't work long for them, but what was that experience like?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was around for the last 8 months of Empire. I already worked for James Cummings and Makeup Effects Lab, and I just finished about 3 months over at Lance Anderson's place on The Serpent and the Rainbow and Michael Jackson's Moonwalker. And times, a job ends and suddenly you've got to go look for another one. And I've been going over to John Beekler's place for a few years interviewing, and finally the opportunity came up. They had hired me once before on Cellar Dweller, but the money ran low, and so he had to call me and cut me before I started. But I actually went back and started up on a film called Prison. By the end of the year, maybe a few months after in there. We did a few days on robot jogs, which is basically just some insert shots of injured audience members, or you know, people that have been watching the game, and the robot falls into the crowd, and so our stuff is just a lot of aftermath stuff that was shot here in LA.
Right.
But Arena, though, I mean, we had just finished Ghost Town, and we were just starting Arena about September of 87, and that went for 3 months in LA building, because I remember, I met Scott Coulter in New York. He had already flown out there, but he and I met in New York and then flew to Italy at the end of November, and Mike Beek was already over there, and the other guys started showing up soon after that. But that was like that was like 2 months in LA building stuff, and then it was 3 months in Italy. And John had given me, while we were working on the film, I know that they had like picked the crew, and I wasn't part of it, so I was kind of content with just moving on to John's next film, which is Friday the 13th, Part 7.
Right.
But John pulled me in his office one day and offered me he gives me a choice. He says, either you can stay here in LA and design Jason for Friday the 13th, or you can go to Italy on Arena. And because my whole goal for working for Empire and MMI and stuff was to go to Italy, obviously I'd already made my choice, so I went over there. And what an experience that was, with shooting at the old Dino De Laurentiis studio. Charlie Band still owned it. It was an amazing 3 month period. We worked with some of the coolest people, and we had Paola Cazzo, who was in Demons. The girl who the demon crawls out of her back. She had a small cameo role that's not even in the film.
Right.
I remember, we all remember her on set. You know, and Ken Clark, who was the star of Attack of the Giant Leeches, was in the film. And Robert Spafford, who had done voiceovers on hundreds and hundreds of films since the 1960s, so guaranteed you know his voice. Mm-hmm. He had a small role in the film, and just a really great experience, especially with all the actors that we had and the crew. Screen Magic and Steve Lang were great too, and mm-hmm. I ended up helping them out a lot.
Yeah, they're wonderful. I really do cherish that era. There's been a lot of great books about the Empire, and there's a documentary still in the works that chronicles the history of Empire Pictures. But it was
of Empire. I'm part of all three of those entities. I did the chapter on the in the Empire of the Bees book, and then I did a lot of stuff for the Full Moon book, and I did my interview for the documentary also. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that, just to see the history and hear from everybody's voices.
It's incredible.
Apparently Charlie himself.
Yeah.
Apparently it's a very candid, conversation with Charlie also, which will be very fascinating.
Yeah. Incredible pictures. So we move on. Another one I sort of noticed, in there was, of course, The Blob, Chuck Russell's remake of The Blob, which is has become a cult classic. I know that there's been rumors that they're trying to do another remake of it.
Oh yeah.
Currently.
Sure.
What was working on The Blob like?
Wow, it was, again, that was sort of a goal for me, because when I was a teenager, when I was growing up, the film Equinox was the one that sort of my initiation, and Dennis Muir and Dave Allen and Jim Danforth had done that, but it was released by then Jack H. Harris, who had produced the original Blob, and through the fascination of Equinox, I spent a lot of time, with Dennis and David, all those guys, and so I managed to contact Jack when I was a teenager, maybe 15 years old or so, and we started up a correspondence, and he even accepted a treatment for Equinox 2 from a friend of mine and I. But it was really cool. I just got back from Italy, and about 2 weeks off, and everybody in town was going to the blob shop, so I went down there and got myself a job, and was there for, I was only on for about a month and a half, though. I kind of like, it was such a, it was a really tough job, and they had me like working, like, I'd go to Hollywood for the shop, for a few hours and work there, and then I'd drive to the first unit shoot up in Valencia and work with the actors for a bit, and then I'd drive all the way out, like miles and miles to the visual effects unit, and then finish the day out in the miniatures, and for maybe 3 weeks or so I was doing that. It was so tedious. It was a really long, it was very fun. It was a lot of really great people aboard it, which was so cool. And we were working with just a lot of my heroes also. And everybody sort of got to really be a part of it, which was really gratifying. But you know, about a month and a half in, and I did a lot of stuff for it, but I got a call from Lance Anderson saying, hey, I just got in the new, James Bond film, License to Kill, and we're doing some sharks for it. You want to come over and work? And I said, absolutely. So I managed to go from back to back. but really, that short time that I was on, still, I felt like I did everything on that. And as a matter of fact, I told them that I was moving off. They were going to make me one of the lead sculptors. I felt a little bad about it, but I gave him 2 weeks' notice, and everything was on the up and up, so everybody was really cool. And working with Lyle Conway was a dream.
I think that's the title of your autobiography right there, Jeff, From the Blob to Bond.
There you go. I like that one. I never thought of that before.
That's a good one. Take my money now. That's a New York Times bestseller.
Well, if it ever happens, you'll get a royalty.
That'd be a good one, I think. Another one. Your company is called Obscure Artifacts. Is that right?
Yeah.
And oddly enough, you worked on a film that I consider a real obscure artifact, particularly for children of my generation, that was more prevalent. But you worked on the Garbage Pail Kids, the movie, which is a real obscure artifact to find it, because it's a very tough film to get a hold of. I still have an old VHS copy of it. Can you tell us a little bit
it's airing on television.
Is it?
Yeah, well, it's airing on television these days. Yeah,
oh, really?
In the States on it's a channel called Comet TV, and they also you can stream it also, but it's running again next month.
Oh, wow.
So.
Okay.
Actually, that was John Beekler's job. That was I had just finished over at Lance Anderson's on Serpent and the Rainbow, and you know, you're without a job and looking around. John had already agreed to bring me on because they were really ramping up. That last year was a really busy year over at MMI. And John was already in production on the Garbage Pail Kids movie when I came in. And it actually ended up being my first screen credit. So I kind of have a soft spot for it. It's a really quirky film, and I always had a weird, like, weird primal fear of Anthony Newley as a kid from seeing him on, like, the Carol Burnett show and stuff. He always seemed so odd and affectatious, you know. And I remember him from Dr. Dolittle also.
Right.
And then I find myself on set with him.
Yeah.
So I had to do either one of those, like, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown moment, or I got to, like, get this out of me. But he turned out to be really cool, and it turned out to be a really good experience. But I was only there on set. I was working in the shop mostly at that time, and I'd go on set only when they needed the extra help. It was a really troubled production from what I recall, though. It was, but looking back on it, boy, what an amazing experience it is, because film is like each film is like a time capsule.
It is, yeah.
And to see that, yeah, to see that film now, especially with a lot of the locations, were just shot around here in the San Fernando Valley.
Right.
So some of them have changed, and some are still the same. So, who knows? Maybe one day I'll snap a few photos of one of the locations, and I'll send it off to you.
Oh, that's cool. So. That's wonderful. Well, from obscure movies to films that most people have heard of, you've worked on some big ones. The likes of Tombstone and Demolition Man. Can you tell us about those ones?
Oh, well, Tombstone was such a great experience. That was when I was starting Obscure Artifacts, and that was mostly I've been doing garage kits up to that point, and then it came, I started getting other things. But Tombstone was a makeup artist friend of mine, David Atherton, had got the job, and he needed a place to do to do the lab work for the prosthetics and stuff. So since he and I got along so well, he said, "Hey, we'll just do it at your place, and you'll have a job, and I'll and you'll get a lot of work out of it." I went, "Great." We started doing a lot of stuff for a lot of gore gags, some pretty heavy duty stuff. When the original director and boy, his name is escaping me, wrote the screenplay, but he had a lot of gore written into the script, and by the time George Cosmatos came in, a lot of it had been toned down. So there's still a number of our things in there, and I'm really proud of little gags like Bill Paxton shot with the bullet wound in his back, and a big prosthetic on him with the tubing. But my favorite one was Michael Biehn's character. I mean, he gets shot in the head.
Right.
I built it. They were a fully engineered little, gag with a they could fit a squid into the prosthetic and do all of that stuff. So it was a pretty big deal. And
that's great.
Michael and I went and saw each other a couple of years ago and had a good laugh about the state of my shop when he walked in. It was, he came a day early and my shop was just a mess. It was a wreck.
Yeah.
But I managed to get his life cast done. That was a lot of fun. And then Demolition Man was over at ADI for Tom Woodruff Jr. and Alec Gillis.
Right.
And huge show. It was a huge, huge show with a lot of bodies that we made. We made the Stallone body and the Wesley Snipes bodies, as well as all the bodies in the cryo chamber.
Oh, right. Wow. Okay.
And eventually, after the lab work was done, about 3 months worth of work in the lab. And eventually they called me and said, "Hey, can you go to Warner Brothers and hang out on set with these bodies?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure, I got nothing else to do." So pretty nice payday, go to Warner Brothers every day, hang
out. Man, I wish I get a phone call like that.
Got there. It's really cool. It's just one of those really lucky experiences. But I got left on set alone with it for a while, and they'd come up and they'd say, "Hey, how does the body look?" And I'd walk over, and it's encased in a giant acrylic hockey puck, and I'd go, "It looks great."
Yeah.
And walk away. They just have to come up and wipe the dust off of it, but it was that was art department's job, not mine.
Yeah,
so.
Fantastic.
But other than that, it was a great, great experience. And Stallone was very, very cool, as was Wesley Snipes. And the director, Marco Brambilla, was just...
Yeah.
Just a great guy.
Yeah, it's a great movie. But yeah, I live for the day I get one of those phone calls, Jeff, where they say, come out and hang out, come and hang out on the lot at Warner Brothers. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll pay you to do it. Wonderful.
I drive by there all the time, and just actually have the chance to be on the lot was very cool.
That's awesome. Well, next time when I watch Demolition Man, when I see those big ice cubes, I'll think of you. So you worked on another couple of films. You worked on actually a couple of polar opposite sort of Jack Nicholson pictures. One being Wolf, and the other one was As Good as It Gets. What was it like on those pictures?
Well, it's so funny because he, like a number of other big name actors, I've done numerous films with and never met.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, it, just to have a credit though, I think on the film is good enough. But on, again, on Wolf, I was over at ADI. It was their job, and, and I was part of the crew, working on the Wolf puppets, as well as, we did the fighting heads at the end of the film, where Jack Nicholson and James Spader are fighting. Rick Baker handled all, obviously, all the prosthetic and makeup works.
Right.
But it was ADI's job to do all the puppets and items like that. And Rick Baker was just amazing, so cool about providing us with every bit of reference and information that we could need. Was so gracious of him. And, but it was a great experience working for a top-notch studio that does the best work. And you know, what can you say about that? But on As Good As It Gets, that was Michelle Burke's job. She was, hired to key the makeup department on the show.
Right.
And I had already done some work for her on a film that Richard Rush directed called The Color of Night.
Right.
And so Michelle at that point called me back in, and even on The Color of Night, I was kind of running the show. I wasn't doing a lot of the sculpting or stuff, but on As Good As It Gets, she had me do the sculpture for Greg Kinnear's pieces, you know, when he's in the hospital.
Oh, okay. And, right.
It's a thrilling experience in doing Greg Kinnear's life cast was the day that we both found out that we've been working at Empire Pictures at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Greg was a production assistant at Empire.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
So,
Hollywood really is a
little
small
bit of trivia for you.
Hollywood really is a small town. I said Hollywood really is a small town.
Yeah, it really super is. But we got all the stuff, made it through Michelle, and then her and Ed French went down and applied all the pieces on set. And it was through that connection that Ed started hiring me, and I had a great time with him for about 10 years. And Ed had done films like, Sleepaway Camp and, Tales from the Tape, like done the Tales from the Dark Side show and stuff
like that.
But he's another super prolific makeup artist. So.
Yeah. Incredible.
Another just really great experience. Pretty quick. I think we only had about we had less than a couple of weeks, I think, to throw all that stuff together.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more than that. But it was a good payday.
Hmm, sure. Well, anyway, onto the topic of particular interest, the sequel to the 1959 Killer Shrews, Return of the Killer Shrews, directed by Steve Latshaw, who I've already had the pleasure of speaking with. How did you come to work on Return of the Killer Shrews?
Boy, Steve and I went all the way back to his film Dark Universe when Fred Olen Ray hired me to do an extra effect for it that was shot in post-production here in L.A., a guy's face like expanding into a creature's head, which was sort of like an early CGI morph effect. But I had done Jacko with him also.
Right.
As well as Steve had written the script for a Sci-Fi Channel movie that I had done called Stan Lee's Lightspeed.
Right, right.
A superhero film that Stan Lee executive produced. But so we kept, crossing paths. So, and he and his line producer, Dan Golden, Dan had, known me from some films we had done together. And they said we need someone cheap to do. This is an expensive way. Is it going to laugh at us? As a matter of fact, they didn't really call me to do a shrew head for it. It was sort of, I talked them into it.
Okay.
I don't think they're really planning on doing a puppet. And I said, we need this. We can't do it. So I sort of bit off more than I could chew in some ways. So, certainly nobody to blame but myself for the extra effort. But so we didn't really get to do a lot of makeup effects in the film because the shoot was so tight. It's a lot of, you know, CG blood and stuff. And,
right.
And I don't give the guys any yeah, I don't give the CGI guys any guff because they had a lot of work to do, and I think it kind of follows the spirit of the original film in some ways.
Right.
But I had been sent a design for the shrew after it already started sculpting the puppet head, and I looked at mine, and I looked at theirs, and I went, and I contacted Steve, and I said, and they'd already paid me, and I said, listen, can I just give you your money back? I was already working on Universal Soldier 4 at the time. I was supervising all the building of the prosthetics in my lab, so I had plenty of work. And I kind of went, Pete, can I give you your money back and pass on this? And they like, well, and then they actually changed the design around to match what I was doing rather than the other way around. And,
right.
But overall, I mean, I'm really so proud to have been involved in it. They're all such good guys, and they're really, really earnest about what they do and, you know, making these films, and then they had a really good cast, and having James Best come by the shop and getting to spend some time with him on set.
Yeah.
It was just such a really wonderful experience. He's such a great guy.
Yeah.
I just saw his wife again a couple of weeks ago, and, she had talked about how, you know, what it was, that he had always really enjoyed the experience of coming by the shop, and, you know, always talked about it, so
that's it's one of
just great, great, great experiences.
Because it was a long time between drinks for him. I mean, the first one was 59, and then I think 2011 was the sequel finally. So you know, that's a
it's such a long time for a sequel to come along, and it puts it into a certain, you know, certain pantheon. I worked on another film called The Primevals for Full Moon. That's where it started life in 1965, didn't shoot until 1994, and it's finally being finished and going to be released next year. So
wow.
That's a long time. I'm working on all kinds of those films.
That's great.
Maybe my longevity is coming from films from the past. So, still, what a great experience to be, just an honor to be involved in a film that has such, you know, visibility and its cult status. You know, I'm talking about Killer Shrews.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to be part of an official sequel to it. I still have people to this day saying, I didn't know you did that.
Yeah.
No,
it's great. When I was talking with Steve, I was like, when I was sent the screener to review and I started watching it, I realized that I'd already seen it. And I said to him, because you know, its initial release was, I believe, reasonably limited. But it wasn't released as Killer Shrews over here. In its initial release, it came out over here as a movie called Mega Rats. It was called Mega Rats.
I have seen that box art.
Yeah.
I think I've seen a German box art version of it with that title.
Yeah.
I like that.
And I was like, I was watching it with my wife, and I said, I've seen this. And she said, but it's just being released. I said, no, I've seen this, I'm sure. And I went back and looked through my shelf, and I pulled out. I said, this is it. It's Mega Rats. It's the same movie. So I was like, you know, because they do that a lot over here. There's a lot of movies that come out in the States have a different title over here.
Sure.
Like Trances, as you know it over there, is Future Cop over here. And another one, one that's always notable is a Dolph Lundgren movie called I Come in Peace or something like that. But over here it was released as Dark Angel. And so sometimes when I'm talking with...
Well, you know, it's so funny. You guys are getting the original titles then, because Dark Angel and the other one, the one prior to that, those were the titles the films were shot as.
Oh, okay.
And so you're getting... Yeah, you guys are getting the actual... Yeah, you have a Future Cop. Yeah, that was the original. That was the shooting title for Trancers.
Oh, okay. Right.
So, you know, and... Yeah, but it's really cool that there are... their versions of that film out with those titles, because those are sort of the way that they're originally meant to be seen.
Yeah, because I mean, even with the when the posters come out, they come out with the, you know, it's got Future Cop and whatever on there. But it's interesting.
That's cool.
It's interesting when I talk to people, you know, in the industry over there and mention a movie and they go, no, I didn't do that. And I said, well, you did, but it was a different, because they know it as a different title. So it's weird sometimes. But I said, yeah, that's, well, I started watching this movie. I said, I've seen this. I'm sure I've seen it. But I knew it as Mega Rats, not as,
Mega Rats.
Return of the Killer Shrews.
Attack of the Mega Rats.
Yeah.
Or Return of the Mega Rats. That would be the sequel to Mega Rats.
Mega Rats. So, you know.
They can just make a sequel to Mega Rats now.
Yeah. Mega Rats 3.
And then just keep...
You know.
That'll be the future of... There won't be remakes. There won't be offshoots. It'll just somehow like be just... You know, the titles will create a whole franchise.
Well, I mean, that's something that some of those... B movie guys used to do a lot of was just simply re-release movies under different titles.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I love that stuff. I mean, I think of, you know, the Italian film titles. You know, that get, you know, the films that get released in different regions or different titles, and there's always something. Yeah, there's always something really interesting about it. I'm sure I've got a couple, but I can't think of any offhand. Right?
Yeah, I love the fact I spoke with Danny Bilson last year, who also worked for Charlie Band at one point.
Oh yeah.
And I love the fact that most of the time, with he and Paul, who sadly has passed now, Paul DeMeo.
Yes.
Most of the time they got a poster first, and then they'd say, "Go write this." They've got the poster. I love the fact that...
Sure, Well, I remember reading the script for Arena, and it literally was rewritten. We received, literally the day we got to Italy, we leave L.A., and this is a day, you know, traveling from one place to another, and we go to L.A., It's one script. There's an entire scene at the end of the film where Mr. Rogor steals this some sort of fighter vehicle or something. There's a space battle at the end or something like that. That's how Rogor is killed instead of, you know, standing there with egg on his face like he does at the end of the film that's released. But and then we get to Italy, and then suddenly that's completely out, and there are, four new aliens added, that we went into the storeroom at Empire Studios and pulled out, creatures left over from Dolls and From Beyond, and I found a couple of ghoulies. I brought one home. I brought a couple of ghoulies home with me from Ghoulies 2, But, you know, we all start working on these alien creature suits, you know, for this extra scene, which is a little montage. That's the way it was. It was all fluid and the scripts were, but the scripts are so much fun. I mean, especially that Arena script. It's such a fun film and it's so sad because art direction wise or production design wise, it's maybe the last film of an era. Because it's designed so like an Antonio Margheriti film, or something like Wild Wild Planet or Bava's Planet of the Vampires. I swear that some of the weapons used in Arena, like the props, were left over from Planet of the Vampires.
That's fantastic.
The rifles and stuff like that, I recognize them. So they're probably just in there in a prop house and just rented for the show.
Yeah, that's incredible.
But it did. It had a certain charm to it that just is gone now.
That leads me to my.
I feel very fortunate to have been involved.
Yeah, that leads me to my last question. Uh-huh. You've been in the business long enough now to see the evolution. Sort of come around. You began. There was still in a time where there was a lot of practical effects. and makeup effects. Uh-huh. And I mean, nowadays there's always that, you know, the first response is, oh, well, we can just fix it in the computer, or we can add it in the computer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what has it been like, I guess, watching that slow progression from the very hands-on filmmaking to this digital era?
Well, it's a fascinating question, because, I mean, yeah, when I got in 77, it was still film. You know, film and videotape were the mediums, and that was before even, like, that was, like, just prior to, like, VHS being, like, kind of becoming a thing. And so, I kind of transitioned from film to the video market, and then into the DVD, you know, suddenly release, and now the Blu-rays, and into the digital technology, and it's weird, because it's streamlined things in some ways, but it's erased things that I think are really necessary. You know, everything seems so compressed these days, and because the technology is easier to work with in some ways, I don't think it should change the way films are made. You know, with a lot of people eliminated, and then, you know, people are doubling and tripling up on duties, and that never really helps. When you're too overwhelmed and shoot schedules. I mean, I've worked on 4-day features that have gone better than 20-day features. But it all depends on the planning, and that's something that I see that seems to be kind of going by the wayside, is the sort of diligent planning that it took to make a lot of these films that we see, where you really got a lot of content, even in a low-budget film. These days, it just doesn't seem the same. People will take shortcuts. But then again, every once in a while, you know, films slip through that break, you know, that break my mind and are really fascinating and really well made. So I think as people, you know, we're transitioning into this new technology and we're getting better and better at it, you know, maybe by the time another dozen or 20 years roll down the road, it's going to be like the old days, you know, because we're starting to see that creep in again.
Yeah.
I'd like to see films with color and films shot with natural light and not toyed with in post-production and suddenly given, you know, the teal and orange treatment where just you're down to a two color palette. And it makes films just unwatchable and I think visually boring as far as I'm concerned. Right? Mm. I'll watch a Sergio Leone film or any spaghetti western these days over almost any one of the current slate of horror films that come out. I think they're bad films, but I've just sort of lost interest in them. They all seem too much alike.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny you brought that up, because that seems to be the overall consensus, is it's become very much a cookie cutter industry, where everyone is very similar to the other, because that one did well, so why, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it sort of attitude.
Yeah. I don't know, I think we should take the lead from the Italians, from, you know, with the way they used to make films. Film would come out, be a hit, and some of you have 100 or 200 knockoff films, and each one had a different, like, kind of a different style to them, depending on the filmmaker. And a heck of a lot of them are really entertaining, probably even more entertaining than the original films.
I know, incredible stuff. I remember in the wake of The Road Warrior, or Mad Max 2, as we know it.
Yeah.
The Italian post-apocalyptic movies that came after that are literally...
Oh, yeah.
There's one called Warriors of the Wasteland. I think that's the title, the same over there.
I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, which is an absolutely incredible knockoff. It stars Fred Williamson. Fred the Hammer.
Fred Williamson, yeah.
But it's an incredible... That's a...
Some of the hairstyles are like, I think that's Andrew G. Castellari directed Warriors of the Wasteland, and he had his brother in it, and probably the wildest hairstyle. It's like, but then again, that's, you know, something. That's what we're in the future. We'll have more time for that, because all we're going to spend our time looking for is gas and food and water. So we'll have plenty of time to do our hair.
Well, Jeff, mate, I'd love to sit and talk with you for hours, but I know it's your day off.
Sure.
I know it's your day off, so I'm going to leave you in peace. But it's been absolutely tremendous talking to you. I hope if I ever get over to Los Angeles at some point, I'll drop by the shop and harass you for a while.
Oh, heck yeah. If you hope you come to LA, if I'm ever in your neck of the woods, I'd love to meet up with you.
Yeah, that'd be cool. We'll have a beer and talk about movies.
Absolutely.
Sounds good. But anyway, well done. I hope it all continues to go well. Everything you've got going, everything that you're working on. All the listeners out there, Killer Shrews, Return of the Killer Shrews is out there now. It's streaming. Jeff Farley is my guest. He did some work on the film. He's worked on many great films. So check out Return of the Killer Shrews. If you've already seen it as Mega Rats, then you can check it out again under a different name, because you mightn't have seen it in a while.
The original name.
What's that?
Yeah, the name it was meant to be under. The name it was meant to be under. It's like a whole new film.
Yeah, yeah. This is the original. This is the film the filmmakers originally intended you to see. So forget Mega Rats. See Return of the Killer Shrews before Mega Rats 3 comes out. Return of the Cheese. Or Bad Cheese. That'd be a good title for it. Mega Rats 3. Bad
Wonderful.
Cheese.
There you go.
Yeah.
I like that. Wonderful. Well, Kent, thank you so much for the time and let me, bore your listeners. So I appreciate it.
No, hopefully they're very entertained. My guest, thank you very much again, Jeff Farley. And thank you for being on Podcasting Them Softly.
Well, thank you again, Kent. You take care of yourself.
All right, mate. Have a good rest of your Halloween day off.